This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
In Paris in 1953, one of the strangest and most popular plays of the 20th century premiered, Waiting for Godot, written by the Irish writer Samuel Beckett.
Godot was the play that made Beckett, without question. It was really almost immediately successful.
Its success was surprising, given its many unusual qualities. For one, it is a play where nothing seems to happen. Also, it was written in French, which was not Beckett's native language. In addition, it was his first play produced on stage. Not everyone loved it. Some people reportedly stormed out of the premiere. But overall, it was well received.
He nonetheless garnered a couple of good early reviews and very quickly became a subject of conversation in Paris, such that everybody wanted to go to see En Attendant Godot at the time, and then there were quickly requests for productions elsewhere, leading him to a fame that he never felt comfortable with. He remained a very private individual. My name is Peter Connor. I teach French and comparative literature at Barnard College in New York.
Since the premiere, people have been trying to figure out what this play means. It's been interpreted in countless ways, with no definitive confirmation from Beckett one way or another.
There's an enormous amount of affirmation in Beckett. It's not a literature of negation at all. It's a literature of lessness. It's also a literature of worseness. I mean, he's relentless with... I mean, the second act is worse than the first. Everything tends towards worseness.
Welcome to Writ Large, a podcast about how books change the world. I'm Zachary Davis. For this episode, I sat down with Professor Peter Connor to discuss Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. Samuel Beckett was born to a wealthy family in Dublin, Ireland in 1906.
They had a large Tudor-style family home in an exclusive suburb of Dublin called Fox Rock. The house had a name, Kuldrina. It had tennis courts, it had a croquet lawn. So he was part of the prosperous Protestant and therefore minority community of Ireland at the time.
Growing up Protestant in heavily Catholic Dublin instilled a sense of isolation in Beckett that would remain with him throughout his life.
He was educated at Portora Royal School, which was also for Protestants. Ireland was really very segregated at the time. And that school was in the northern part of Ireland. It was in Enniskillen, which is about 100 miles northwest of Dublin. So he was sent as a boarder away from his family home. He excelled at school. He was a very good student. He was a very good athlete, particularly at cricket. He was excellent at cricket. But he was generally very athletic and was interested in sports and played sports.
Beckett then enrolled in Trinity College Dublin, where he studied modern literature and philosophy. After graduating, he taught briefly at Campbell College in Belfast, before becoming a lecturer at the prestigious École Normale Supérieure in Paris. While in Paris, Beckett met the esteemed Irish author James Joyce. They became fast friends, and Beckett ended up helping Joyce with research for his 1939 novel, Finnegan's Wake. Throughout this time, Beckett wrote various pieces of his own, including poems, short stories, and essays. After a couple years, he left Paris and got a position as a lecturer back at his alma mater, Trinity College.
But his experience of teaching was very displeasing to him. He really didn't like teaching at all. He felt that he was not good at it. It brought him no pleasure. And so he resigned his position, much to the chagrin of his mother. He resigned that rather prestigious position at Trinity College and remained then in Ireland, living at home, in good surroundings, but in a kind of suffocating atmosphere, suffocating partly because of, his mother's love was a complicated business for him. She fussed about him. And he understood, I mean, the hope had been that Sam would take over the family business. Father was a quantity surveyor, very successful. His father had been a building contractor. There was considerable money at stake. And, you know, Beckett didn't want to do this at all. Eventually, his brother, he had an older brother, Frank, who took over the family concern. Beckett knew when he failed at teaching that he wanted to be a writer. So that didn't come about immediately, although he had some early publications. But in the 1930s, he was trying to find what kind of writer he would be.
He continued to write poetry and short stories. In 1931, he published an essay called Proust, which was a critical study of the French novelist Marcel Proust. A couple years later, his father passed away.
After his father's death, he had a psychologically difficult time and wanted to do a psychoanalysis, which was illegal in Ireland at the time, which gives you an idea of what kind of society he was growing up in. So he went to London then. In London, he felt like a complete outsider. I think that outsider, that feeling of being an outsider, accompanied him most of his life. He talks about it in terms of solitude, but it's also tinged with a kind of alienation, and that it probably comes from his origins as a Protestant in Dublin. So someone who can't really fully identify with the idea of being Irish, fully Irish in a very traditional sense that he would have rejected anyway, but he didn't feel fully Irish, and he certainly didn't feel English. There's a lovely anecdote when a journalist says to him at the beginning of an interview, you're English, Mr. Beckett. And Beckett says, on the contrary. Whatever that means. It doesn't necessarily mean he's Irish, but the point here, I think, is that he is not really, the route of being an Irish writer is neither available to him nor desirable to him. But he's not English or British either in any sense. So that cosmopolitanism that Joyce incarnated for him did seem like a very attractive avenue. And that's what he needed to get back to, and that's what he did get back to in 1937 after he went on a tour of Germany, which was very influential also for the writing of Waiting for Godot. So after that, then he went and more or less stayed in Paris, or in France in any case, until the end of his life.
When Beckett initially settled in Paris in the late 1930s, he was writing mostly prose and writing in English. But his creative process began to change in the years following World War II.
There's going to be a dramatic shift that comes after the war when he has a tremendous creative burst that coincides with his decision to switch from writing in English to writing in French, which is rather unexpected. You find instances of the other direction. Writers who write perhaps in a lesser well-known language might wish to write in English to reach a bigger audience, but he had very different concerns about language and reservations about the possibility of expressing himself as he wished to in English. So he made that decision, made that switch, and after the war began writing in French, prose still.
He quickly wrote three novels in French that are known as his great trilogy, Molloy, Malone Dies, and The Unnameable.
And during that, apparently in order to take some kind of a break from the arduousness of writing this prose in French and working on it, he wrote Godot very quickly. In the matter of 4 or 5 months, he wrote this play. There had been another play, but it was never produced. Godot is really the start of his theatrical career, so it's his first play. So its success is all the more remarkable in that he wasn't at all experienced in the theater. He had never had a play produced on stage.
Before Waiting for Godot, Beckett had achieved some literary success, but he wasn't really able to fully support himself through his writing. So he did translation and other writerly gigs to make ends meet. But Waiting for Godot became such a smash hit that it finally gave Beckett that most elusive condition for artists, financial security.
Could you sketch just kind of his post-Godot life till his death?
He continued to write prose and theater. And what's interesting in the theater, I think, is how when you think of the radicality of Waiting for Godot, which was a shock on the Parisian scene, which is not easy to shock. It really, you might think, well, that there is his major statement for the theater. But in fact, he had such imaginative powers that this was really only the beginning of a process, which one sees also in his prose. I guess I might choose the word lessness to describe it, which is the title of one of his works. He's going to go in the direction of lessness. This is the opposite direction from Joyce. I'm sure you've read some Joyce, and you see that Joyce's tendency is to be encyclopedic. You just have to look at the size of Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake to see that he was always adding. And if you look at the proofs, he's adding to the last moment to get more and more in there, more knowledge and so on.
Life overfills the cup.
It does. And Beckett realized that his way would be really quite opposite to that. He would go in the direction of lessness and in the direction of also ignorance and incapacity, inability. He calls himself at one point a non-knower and a non-canner. A non-knower and a non-canner. He doesn't know and he can't. So he's in this kind of a bind that is inevitably going to lead him to failure. And he feels the need to embrace that failure. And he sees in, particularly in artworks, he was very sensitive to painting, that the true artist, it will fail. That failure is integral to the artistic task. And he wanted to recognize that. So in his post-Godot years, he put that into effect. So if you look at Godot, it's a radical play, but it still has some conventions that he was going to challenge and change. And this is how I think he altered the theater in a very profound way, by doing away with a number of conventions, that when we go to the theater, we expect to see certain things. We expect to see characters. We expect to see plot. We expect to see certain kind of exchanges. And he's going to challenge every single one of those. And he does so already in a quiet way in Godot, but he can go much further. So if you think, for example, just of the human body on the stage, that's something that's going to be subject to the idea of lessness that he wants to put into effect in the next plays. He'll have plays, for example, where the body seems to disappear increasingly. In the next play, Endgame, there are two characters who live in trash cans, for example, dustbins. In subsequent plays, there's going to be less and less of the full human body. He'll bury characters up to their waist, or Winnie in Happy Days up to her neck in sand. Or there'll be characters who are encased in vases, so you only see their heads. And then there'll be a play called Not I, which is just a spotlight fixed on a mouth. So all you see is the mouth moving. And then there'll be plays with no characters at all, and plays with no words at all. So there's this movement towards lessness.
Let's move now to the play itself. So it's famously a play about nothing, but could you, for our listeners, try, insofar as it's possible, to give us a kind of plot summary or, you know, general arc of the story?
So Waiting for Godot it's a play in which nothing happens twice, because there are two acts that essentially mirror each other. In the first act, the scene opens with two rather tramp-like figures, although they're never called tramps, waiting for a character called Godot. And they're passing the time by exchanging words. They don't appear to be saying anything of very great significance to one another, nothing of momentous consequence, nothing that seems to be knitting together some plot or plot line. At a certain moment, Pozzo and Lucky, the two other main characters in the play, appear. Lucky is Pozzo's slave. Pozzo is taking Lucky to the market to sell him for a good price, he hopes. Lucky is attached to Pozzo by a long rope, which goes around his neck, and responds to commands from Pozzo. He carries his bags, he carries his chair, and generally acts as his servant or slave. At a certain moment, Pozzo asks Lucky to think, and that produces a very long speech, by far the longest in the play, and it's very strange, unintelligible, I think, to an audience, unintelligible even now to scholars who have had the opportunity of sitting quietly in their office and reading the play. Looks like a parody of professorial discourse, at the limit of sense, but nonetheless gesturing towards themes that have been evoked between Vladimir and Estragon, the two tramps, earlier in the play. Then they go off, a boy comes, and he has a message from Mr. Godot to say that Mr. Godot won't come today, but he'll surely come tomorrow. Vladimir and Estragon are then alone on the stage. The moon rises. They contemplate it for a moment. They decide that they'll go because the night has fallen, and they remain nonetheless on the stage. The curtain comes down. Act two opens. Vladimir sings a song about a dog and death. Estragon is there too. They exchange words. They go through routines. Pozzo and Lucky reappear, although changed. Pozzo is now blind. Lucky is mute. They move on. A boy appears, a messenger from Monsieur Godot. He's questioned in a rather irritated way by Vladimir, who's becoming increasingly frustrated, appears. And the message is the same as the first message. Monsieur Godot will not come today, but he'll surely come tomorrow. So the boy leaves. The two are left alone on the stage. The moon rises. They contemplate the possibility of hanging themselves from the sole piece of theatrical equipment on the stage, which is a tree. There's a tree on the stage. The directions, or it's a country road with a tree, and that's all there is. So they consider this, but they don't have a rope. They say, well, we'll bring a rope tomorrow. They decide that they'll leave. They do not leave, and the curtain falls.
While on the surface, this might seem to be a play about nothing but waiting, there is a subtlety in the original French title of the play that suggests there is more to it.
There's everything that they do while they are waiting for Godot, which is something very stressed in the French version, French title being En attendant Godot. And that on, the first word, means while, really. Beckett dropped it in the translation, but that while, what you're going to do while you're waiting for something to happen, is what the play consists of.
So enigmatic, but somehow it's so brilliantly comic. You can't help but smile at it. You know, how has it been read by scholars and interpreters, literary critics over the years?
Well, it's been read in every way imaginable, precisely because it's so stripped down and bare, and there's really not that much there, which I think puts critics into overdrive, because it's open to all kinds of interpretations, including the one that would be broadly a religious interpretation that would see in the word Godot or Godot the word God. Even in French, that would resonate for a French audience with the idea of God. And of course, together with the theme of waiting, it does look very much like a sort of existentialist or even theological meditation on human existence. So there's nothing wrong with that. Beckett himself is of no help here deliberately. He wouldn't say, he says, everything I knew or everything I know about Godot was in the play. If I had known more, I would have put it in. And there's already enough, and perhaps I could have made done with less. So he's not going to provide an answer. He says if he knew who Godot was, he would have said so in the play. So he knows no more than the characters that he has created. He's not in a position of knowing. He's a non-knower on that, too.
Waiting for Godot has clear existentialist themes, especially the idea that the world is inherently meaningless or absurd.
That evokes Albert Camus, the French writer whose work Beckett would have known very well and who wrote a number of texts that dramatize something like the absurdity of existence. So there's unquestionably elements there. The idea of nothingness that is so central to the play, it's the first word. The first word is nothing, very characteristically of Beckett. Because he felt that he was working with nothing and towards nothing. The first word is nothing. And that idea of nothing and nothingness was in the air. It had been, you know, explored by Jean-Paul Sartre, the great existentialist philosopher, and his major work, Being and Nothingness. It had been explored prior to him by Heidegger, whose works had been translated in the 30s and were becoming known.
A big reason the play is so popular is how relatable it feels for audiences.
What is wonderful about the play, I think, is how it manages to dramatize something essential about the human condition that audiences recognize. That's not easy to do, because in order to do so, you really do have to enter into some pretty profound philosophical questions. Without, nonetheless, resolving those questions, you need to evoke them. And Beckett has the talent and the skill and, I think, the intellectual honesty to do so. And that, I think, is what audiences respond to when they go to that play. They see that this is someone who's dealing very, very straight with them. He's not trying to sell them something. He's not trying to convince them of something. He's not trying to entertain them. So he's not condescending. He never judges, because he doesn't think that he knows anything. And how would judgment come about here? I think that without having any data on this, it's probably the most represented play. And so if people still flock to theaters to see this play, it's because they recognize in the exchanges between Vladimir and Estragon and in other aspects of the play something that reflects their own experience of life. So no fancy discourse. The only fancy discourse is a parody. It's Lucky's Think. And it's not fancy. It's pathetic. It's moving. It's always, everything is always given in Beckett with great compassion, I feel. And I think that one feels that. But one does need to enter into big questions, and he does that very well. Vladimir and Estragon are in the same situation as we are as theatergoers. They're on the stage, but they're also waiting to be entertained. So when Pozzo and Lucky come along, for them that's like entertainment. It's almost like, you know, dinner theater or something. Suddenly there's something happening, and they're very excited and want to engage. And so. And after Pozzo and Lucky leave at one point, Vladimir says, well, that passed the time. And Estragon says, it would have passed in any case. It's very nice. It's very light. Once again, you see that plainness, that simplicity of exchange, but it's quite profound also. It allows you to think a little bit about time and how it passes, and why it might pass more quickly sometimes than others. But there's a kind of intelligence that's not at all exclusive. The address is very familiar. The language is very familiar. And it nonetheless manages to get to something, beyond the surface. So the play is full of that. It's full of very familiar language, very familiar scenes. The two of them, Vladimir and Estragon, they bicker all the time. They argue and so on. They look a bit like a married couple sometimes. They're also very affectionate with one another at moments. They need one another. I think people see in that couple and the fact that they are a couple who are constantly on the stage moving apart from one another and coming together again, as they do. Estragon spends the night, every night in a ditch where he gets beaten. But every morning he comes, or every day, every next day he comes back and finds his friend. And in Vladimir's sort of closing speech, he refers to Estragon as my friend, which I think is very moving. These are very close friends, and a good theater director can play with that and make that evident that, you know, in spite of the awful situation they're in, and perhaps because of the awful situation they're in, the bleakness, they need one another in order to give themselves the impression that they exist, to use some words from the play.
What message do you find most nourishing from it, or maybe most supported? How do you convey this play to some of your students?
What I appreciate most about Beckett is that kind of honesty in representing the human condition as it is, without solutions or remedies. There simply aren't any. It's not an optimistic play, but I think it's a hopeful play. For example, I think we might mention that in the early 1950s, when the battle was still raging to understand this play, and there were people who were for and people who were against and so on, Beckett received a letter from Germany from a prisoner who had gotten hold of the French text and translated the French text into German and staged Waiting for Godot in the prison with actors. And he wrote to Beckett to say that this had been a very successful event and could maybe Beckett come and see the performance. And he said in the letter, you know, we understand this, that apparently the rest of the public doesn't, but any one of the incarcerated knows exactly what this is about, and it's about our experience of life. So there's one population that sort of voted for Beckett and for this play and wanted that and affirmed that. And I think they wouldn't have affirmed it if they didn't see something affirmative in it.
What is hopeful about it? Is it that even these tramps and ditches, their humanity itself has a beauty and dignity, even in its most degraded form?
I think that's very accurate. Yes. They have a humanity and a dignity. It's very difficult to maintain. The physicality of the play is very interesting. Characters are falling down all the time, or almost falling, or staggering, or teetering, or tottering, or tripping, and so on. There's a movement towards the ground, as though maintaining the upright station is something of a challenge. So just to say that there is a recognition of how difficult it is to be a human, that part of our human dignity is in the effort to remain upright and to manage with this very complicated thing that's been inflicted on us, which is life.
You've mentioned that just simply by being so widely staged, of course, it's touched millions of people down the years. But what could we say about the way it influenced other artistic forms? Did it have a larger, you know, cultural impact that we can distinguish?
It has very much influenced subsequent playwrights who were almost obliged to begin to write differently, to abandon old ways in the theater that Beckett had shown to be shown to be old, shown to be antiquated, and had in Beckett had demonstrated this other possibility for the theater. So playwrights like Tom Stoppard or Harold Pinter were very influenced by him, or Edward Albee also. So a new kind of theater was born out of Godot and Beckett's subsequent theatrical works. So it had an influence in the world of theater itself. It had an influence far beyond that, because the fact that so many people know the word Godot, Waiting for Godot, and know what that means, it's rather rare that a quote by, you know, a fairly intellectual Irish, French language writer should be adopted by people who want to describe a situation that they know. If they're taking it to, it's like Waiting for Godot, they know what that means. And so they know that Beckett has produced that, possibly.
Waiting for Godot is famous as a play about nothing. But it has endured because it is, in fact, a play about life. For what is life but a sequential collection of waitings? Waiting for school to end. Waiting to find someone to love. Waiting to know what to do. Waiting to feel better. Waiting for money or recognition. And ultimately, the last waiting. Waiting for death. And yet, between all these waitings, we find meaning to continue on.
Possibly the most important word in Beckett's entire oeuvre is on. On. And it's a play. It's a word that occurs multiple times in Godot. This idea of going on, of keeping on, is close to the idea of not giving up. So it's not heroic. No one would say anybody in Waiting for Godot is a heroic character, I think. But this idea of on, that the fact that they come together each day, it's not pleasant. There's all kinds of awful things. There's a great deal of violence in the play. But they come together again and again. And that idea of on, which is very difficult. I can't go on. I must go on. I'll go on, as Beckett says. So that on is faintly affirmative in my mind. And that faintly or not, that's all that matters. It does for me register or tip that balance away from those who wish to see Beckett as an unredeemed complete pessimist, which he's really not. But no one's going to say he's an optimist. But there is that idea of going on, keeping going, and so on. So I think that that's the affirmative note.
Writ Large is produced by Jack Pombriant and me, Zachary Davis. Our theme song is by Ian Koss, and our branding is by Dan Pecci. We're a member of LitHub Radio. Writ Large is a Lyceum original production. You can find us on our website, writlarge.fm. There, you'll find transcripts, links to the books we discussed, and more information about today's guest. Thanks for listening. See you next time.